habit.
Stay out of this, boy.
His father was drunk, as usual. 6 o'clock in the morning, and he'd been out all night.
Run, Stacy.
His father pulled off his belt, slapped the leather strap on the couch. Don't move, you little bastards. Matthew charged straight at him, a 50-pound bull of a boy plowing into a 200-pound drunk. He knocked his old man flat, shattering a lamp in the tumble.
Run,
shouted Matthew. His father was cursing and swinging wildly, trying to get off his back.
Run, Stacy, run!
Matthew turned to escape, but just as he did, a huge hand grasped his ankle.
Let me go! Let me go!
Silencio!
Matthew was suddenly shaken from his memories. The voice in Spanish had come from somewhere above his dark, covered hole, a place beyond the misery of his childhood. He'd been unaware of his own shouting, though it had obviously been loud enough for the guards to hear. The leaves rattled overhead. Someone was opening the roof. Matthew prepared himself for the sudden burst of light, but even on a cloudy day, the brightness was too much for eyes that lived in darkness. He couldn't look up.
Launch,
the man said. The familiar voice surprised him. It wasn't a guard, he knew, since none but Joaquin spoke English. Slowly he looked up toward the hole in the roof and his eyes began to focus.
Emilio,
he said.
Yeah,
he said, then made a face.
Man, it stinks in here.
Matthew was still woozy.
What? What are you doing here?
Bringing you lunch.
Are you crazy? They'll shoot you.
No, I'm a trustee now.
Huh?
He handed down a tin plate with 2 cold sausages. Just the sight of processed meat had Matthew on the verge of relapse.
Joaquin trusts me now, so he gives me little tasks.
His head was pounding, his belly racked with cramps. It was all so confusing.
Why? He just does.
Matthew slowly rose to his knees, looked Emilio in the eye as best he could from his hole. His thoughts were jumbled from fever, but he struggled to string the truth together.
You ratted on Jan, didn't you?
What?
Jan and I talked just before Nisho's husband was killed. He accused you of telling Joaquin that he was planning an escape. I told him he was crazy. But it wasn't paranoia, was it? You told.
Emilio checked over his shoulder as if to see whether any of the guards were close enough to overhear.
Of course I told, he said softly. I can't believe you did that. I had to. That Swedish trouble, that first day we left the FARC camp, Joaquin warned us what would happen if you tried to escape. If you failed, Joaquin would kill me, the daddy. If you succeeded, he'd kill Rosa, the mommy. He made those rules to keep me from escaping. Not just you. He had the same rules for Jan. And then the idiot came to me, asking me to escape with him. He expected me to leave Rosa behind for Joaquin to execute. Wouldn't you have snitched?
Matthew tried to focus, but in his weakened, sick condition, things were starting to spin. Murders, false accusers, snitches. This was Pitcairn Island.
If Joaquin trusts you, said Matthew, then get me out of here. You know I didn't kill Nisho's husband. Just because Joaquin lets me bring you lunch doesn't mean I can sit down and negotiate with him.
Try, he said, his voice breaking. Somebody has to get me out of this hole. I'm going crazy in here.
Hang in there, okay? I don't think you'll be in much longer. He let Jan out yesterday.
Him, Matthew said, nearly losing it.
Why him? Why am I getting the worst punishment? Maybe Joaquin thinks your spirit is stronger. He wants to break it.
A wave of nausea hit him, chipping away at his will to endure.
If he's going to kill me, tell him to just do it, please. I don't want to go through this hell and end up dead anyway. You can't give up, Matthew. I don't think he'll kill you, even if he thinks you killed Nisho's husband. How do you know? The guards tell me that the Japanese guy wasn't such a big loss, at least from Joaquin's point of view. He thinks Nisho's family will pay as much for her release as they would have paid for both of them. It's not like buying 2 cars with a price tag for each of them. These kidnappers just come up with a big number that they think the family can pay. Joaquin's not going to lower his price just because it's only Nisho's life on the line and not Nisho and her husband.
So I guess he's glad her husband is gone. I wouldn't say glad. I would. Have you seen the way he looks at Nisho? He's more than happy to have her husband out of the way. I haven't really noticed. Then take notice. I don't care if you are a trustee, Emilio. I know you're a decent man. If somebody doesn't stand up to these guards, they're going to have their way with Nisho, then Rosa, then Nisho again and again and again. I can't do anything from in here, so it's up to you. Don't let it happen, you hear me? Their eyes locked. Matthew was stone-faced, unflinching. I'll see what I can do. Emilio pulled away. Matthew just watched as the leaves and fronds returned to their place on the roof overhead, and his hole returned to darkness. Chapter 40. Guillermo canceled on me. I didn't get a specific reason, just a message at my hotel that he couldn't take me out for the Flor de Caña rum and additional rounds of truth-telling that he'd promised. Somehow I wasn't surprised. I ate dinner in my room alone, then called my mother to let her know that I hadn't been eaten by cannibals, thrown into a raging volcano as a human sacrifice, or otherwise victimized in any of the horrible ways that she'd imagined were commonplace in Central America. I didn't tell her about Guillermo and Lindsay. By 9 o'clock, I was bored out of my mind. I went to the balcony and checked out the street life 3 stories below. Pretty dead, except for the usual sights. Teams of kids in the intersection were still selling junk and begging for Cordobas. I was pretty sure they were the same kids I'd seen almost 8 hours ago. The boy with one leg I definitely remembered. Ditto for the girl with the baby face who already had 2 babies of her own, one in each arm. Farther up the street, the strip club with the big red lips painted on the door seemed to be hopping. Groups of men would walk in drunk, get all steamed up, and then come out, one at a time, to cut a $10 deal with one or more of the 13-year-old girls who walked the street in their fishnet stockings and 5-inch heels. What in the hell were my father and sister doing here? I went back inside. I was feeling lonely, a little depressed, and definitely confused. I picked up the telephone and started to dial Alex's number. I hung up on impulse and called Jenna instead. Hey, it's Nick. You got a minute? Okay. I suddenly realized it was Saturday night, almost 11 p.m. in Miami, and that she might be with someone. I can call back. No, it's okay. It's my fault for answering. Now you know I'm one of those lonely girls who sit at home Saturday nights watching reruns on Lifetime. Shame on me, but that made me feel good. I talked a little about the legal case against the insurance company, but only as a pretext for having called her. She steered the conversation toward what she'd done all day. I brought it back to the amazing things I'd seen since landing in Managua, and the rest just flowed. It was easy, reminiscent of countless nights after midnight that we'd gone back to her place with a pint of ice cream and just talked, not really noticing how the time was passing until one of us would look at the clock and say, "My God, it's 4 a.m. "You think you'll find Lindsay?" she asked. It was a hard question to answer without giving her the background. I hadn't told my mother, but another perspective would have been helpful. Jenna's point of view was one I'd always respected, so I told her. "Wow," she said. "Didn't expect that out of your little sister." "Tell me about it. We didn't expect Duncan Fitz to accuse her of masterminding my father's kidnapping either." "I don't want to give Duncan's theory too much credence. But still, have you given any thought as to which way the affair with Guillermo cuts?"
"How do you mean?" I asked.
"Let me step into Duncan Fitz's shoes for a second," she said. "You start with the idea that your father wasn't very happy about his 24-year-old daughter having an affair with a married man twice her age. He forbids her to see Guillermo. It's at least plausible that Lindsay arranged her father's kidnapping as retaliation for his trying to control her life."
"Pretty diabolical, don't you think?"
"Or it could be collusion," said Jenna. "Lindsay and Guillermo may have teamed up and gotten rid of your father because he disapproved of their winter-spring romance."
"Now you're thinking more like Duncan Fitz than Duncan Fitz does."
"Are you saying that you're not even considering those possibilities?"
"Are you saying I should?"
She didn't answer. I tried to read her silence, but my thoughts were interrupted by a knock on the door. I checked the clock after midnight. Even without two spoons and a pint of Oreos and cream, we'd lost track of time. Someone's at the door. I better go.
Ditto, it's 2 o'clock here.
I hesitated, afraid to push the personal issues too far. Jenna, I said, as if testing the waters.
Yeah?
All this Lindsay stuff aside, it was good talking to you. I mean, really talking. I miss that. I sensed a smile on the other end of the line.
Any time.
I smiled to myself.
But, Nick?
I winced. I hated those "but Nicks." What?
Don't ignore what I said about Lindsay. And be very careful down there.
Her voice had a tone that I knew well. She really meant it. I will, I said. Good night. Her good night was followed almost immediately by another knock on my hotel door. I hung up the phone and walked to the peephole. The light in the hallway was burned out, however, and I saw only a silhouette in the darkness. Who is it?
Maria.
Maria who?
Portilla, from Ray's Seafood. We met this afternoon, remember?
I looked again through the peephole, and now the shape was familiar. It was the pretty young receptionist who'd said she'd been praying to the Blessed Virgin for my father. Just a second. I was wearing only jogging shorts, since my air-conditioned room came with a noisy old window unit that was frankly more full of hot air than Guillermo was. I pulled on a T-shirt, then unchained the lock and opened the door. Maria stepped in without waiting for an invitation. She seemed a little nervous as I closed the door.
I'm sorry to come by this late.
From the expression on her face, I could tell this was important. That's okay, I was awake anyway.
I just came from dinner with some of the girls from the office. I didn't know, but one of them said that she thought you were here looking for your sister.
I didn't really want to announce that, but yes, that's one of the reasons I came here. She seated herself on the edge of the bed. I pulled up the desk chair and straddled it, my arms atop the backrest.
I might be able to help you, she said.
How?
I was one of the few friends Lindsay made here. I was the only one she told about her and Guillermo.
So it's true they were lovers? She made a face. I wasn't sure if she was struggling for the right words in English or just struggling with the brutal truth.
Guillermo was in love. Lindsay was, I think the term is, using him.
Using him for what?
Information.
About what? She started to answer, then stopped.
I care very much about Lindsay, but my job is very important to me, to my whole family.
I can understand that. I'm not going to repeat anything, if that's your concern.
The best thing is for me to show you. That way, if anyone ever asks who told you, you don't have to say it was me.
I assumed that by anyone she meant Guillermo. Okay, show me. She rose and said,
In the morning. Pack your bags tonight. I'll pick you up at 6 in front of the hotel.
I stood silent, which she seemed to take as acceptance. She walked to the door and opened it herself. Where are we going? I asked. She hesitated, as if debating whether she should even tell me that much.
Puerto Cabezas,
was all she said. The door closed, and she was gone. Chapter 41. We reached the airport at sunrise. Maria had picked me up right at 6 a.m. I thought we were going to drive, but she laughed.
Did you really think there are decent roads to Puerto Cabezas?
The choice was between two local airlines, but it really boiled down to one. I made it a policy never to travel on any airline that limited its passengers to only one carry-on iguana. It was just the two of us and a pilot in an old and noisy single-engine Cessna. We flew slightly north and then east, directly into the rising sun. For 90 minutes, an endless green forest unfolded below us, rugged in places, rolling elsewhere. Low-hanging clouds curled around the mountains, misty wisps of white that created the illusion of snow-filled valleys. Blue lakes and crystal rivers glistened with the first streaks of daylight. And then I saw the ocean. Old, almost primitive-looking fishing boats bobbed peacefully on undulating seas of midnight blue. A narrow ribbon of sand stretched for miles to the north and south, not a soul in sight, not a footprint anywhere.
It was practically Virgin Beach, the famous Mosquito Coast, La Mosquitia. "Our country is very beautiful, no?" Maria shouted over the whining engine. I nodded and smiled to myself, realizing finally why my father had come. 10 minutes later, we landed. After the picturesque views from above, it was like falling out of bed in the middle of a tropical dream. Maria had neglected to mention the lack of a runway. Heavy rains had washed out the major part of the airstrip. I didn't ask how that made landing in a field any safer. Once on the ground, Maria and I hopped a ride in the back of a banana truck, bounced our way down a muddy trail, and jumped off at the edge of town. Puerto Cabezas was the largest city on Nicaragua's eastern shore, the largest for hundreds of miles along the entire Mosquito Coast. Buildings were old, some made of blocks and some of wood, nearly all in need of paint and basic repairs. Some of the roads were cobblestone, as in Managua, but we'd found a rutted street that was under heavy construction. Within minutes, I was exhausted, the mud pulling at my boots like quicksand. Puddles were like landmines, in the sense that it was impossible to tell which one might actually be a flooded storm sewer with no grate. One careless step and I could have disappeared from the face of the earth, no one to rescue me. It was a sleepy place, especially on a Sunday morning, which added to the very palpable sense of isolation. The city was geographically remote, bordered on the east by the Atlantic Ocean and separated from the rest of the country by mountains, coastal plains, and the largest remaining rainforest in Central America. Culturally, it was distinct. No shadows of Sandino and Che Guevara so omnipresent in the West. This area was home to some 70,000 mosquitoes, the largest remaining group of indígenas, a proud and somewhat autonomous people. "Where are we going?" I asked.
"We need a boat."
Ankle deep in mud, I thought she was exaggerating only slightly. As we continued down the hill and toward the dock, however, I realized that what she meant was a boat to take us offshore. The dirt road to the ocean was lined with shacks and grounded fishing boats that had been washed ashore some years earlier by Hurricane Mitch. The boats looked abandoned, but the laundry line and the naked little kids playing out back made me realize that they'd been converted into homes. The path grew narrower as we neared the water, and finally we broke through the thicket onto the beach. The sounds impressed me most. The gentle waves lapped the shore in a rhythmic, soothing whisper. Seagulls cawed overhead. The warm breeze was barely strong enough to have kept a sail from luffing, yet I could see it moving across the water, little ripples on the surface. My father had taught me how to do that, to see the wind when others couldn't.
"He wants $3.
Maria's voice snapped my daydream. "What?"
"He'll take us where we want to go for $3.
A shirtless old man was standing beside his little wooden boat, ready to go. I dug the bills out of my money belt and gave them to Maria. Wherever we were going, a few bucks seemed reasonable. On the 13th pull, the small outboard started. We headed straight east for about 10 minutes, then veered north toward an 80-foot fishing boat. From 100 yards away, I could see the rows of extra scuba tanks on deck. I'd never seen them in action, but nearly all my life I'd heard my father's stories about the famous mosquito divers. For thousands of years, sea turtles had been their favorite target. A lone diver would swim alongside the turtle, rope it, and then hold on for a rapid descent to the deep, risking digits as he clamped the turtle's mouth shut with his bare hand and forced it to surface. If the diver could hold on long enough, an entire Indian village had food for a week. Sea turtles were a protected species nowadays, but the fishing companies had tapped into those same skills for the harvest of lobsters. The old man killed his little engine, and my ears stopped humming. The waves were bigger this far out, and the small boat rocked a good bit now that we were adrift. "Is that a raised seafood boat?" I asked.
"No, but it's just like the ones we use."
I saw only a few people on deck. "Divers are all down, I guess."
"Yeah, this is where the money is. Probably about 25 of them scooping up lobster."
"They don't use any traps at all?"
"Some. But mostly it's just send the divers down and stuff lobsters in a bag. They are all over the place out here."
"Must be quite a haul."
"Sure it is. These divers are mosquitoes. They're experts. Each one will bring up about 45 pounds of whole lobster a day."
I watched the waves, not sure what the point of this journey was. "So is this what you brought me to see?" Her eyes were fixed on the dinghy 100 yards away. A diver suddenly broke the surface and clung to the side. She handed me a pair of binoculars and said, "That is what I brought you to see." I trained the binoculars on the diver. He looked exhausted, half drowned, his skin turning a strange shade of blue as he coughed up seawater. A frantic crewman finally dragged him into the dinghy. "Looks like he ran out of air."
"Of course he did. They don't use gauges."
I did a double take. "That's crazy. How long do they stay down?"
"They come up and down as they think they need it. Some are better than others at figuring out how long is too long. With no gauges? They could drown, get the bends. Some of them do."
Her voice had an ominous tone. I lowered the binoculars, looked her in the eye. "So this is what Lindsay saw?"
"Plenty of people have seen it. Lindsay was going to write a story about it."
"How did she find out about it?"
"Señor Cruz, I told you she was using him."
"Isn't that a kick in the teeth? Some young American girl sweet-talks him into exposing the Achilles heel of the industry, then dumps him and runs off to her typewriter for her first coup ever as a wannabe journalist."
"That's Lindsay."
"He couldn't have been too happy about that."
"A lot of people weren't happy."
"My father included, I imagine. Which probably made the story all the more attractive to her." I looked again toward that diver lying in the boat, still coughing and trying to recover. Something wasn't adding up. My father, the man I knew, was the last guy on Earth who'd exploit these Indians. Did my father know about this?
"You probably should talk to Lindsay about that."
"That's the whole point. I don't know where she is."
"I told you, people don't want this story told. She's in hiding."
"How do you know?"
"Because I helped her find a place to hide."
"You know where Lindsay is?"
She nodded.
"Can you tell me how to find her?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because you were barely able to handle the streets of Puerto Cabezas. You'd hardly manage your way through the rainforest."
My eyes followed hers till they came to rest on the thickest part of the jungle north of the city. "My sister is in there?"
"Not far, but too far for you to find her."
"Why don't you try me?"
"Why don't I take you?"
she replied. I smiled wryly and said, "Why didn't I think of that?" In Spanish, I told the old guy to take us back to shore. He shook his head firmly and said, "20. $3 to take us out here, 20 to bring us back." I'd seen this one coming. It was just a little thing, but as I handed him a $20 bill, I realized how easy it was to get yourself into trouble out here. The boat turned and pointed toward the rainforest. I couldn't help but wonder, how deep was the mess that Lindsay had gotten herself into? Chapter 42. Matthew was no longer alone in his hole. The rain had stopped, and the standing water had finally drained away. Out of sheer exhaustion, he'd finally lain flat on his back, knees bent. For perhaps as long as an hour, he'd been staring at the dark, thatched roof overhead. His eyes had definitely played tricks in the darkness, but the tiny sliver of light at the far corner seemed real. Without a doubt, an almost imperceptible crack of moonlight or sunlight, he didn't know which, had broken through the thick covering. It was just bright enough to reveal a set of red, beady eyes at the other end of the hole. It seemed to be staring at him, whatever it was. He listened for its breathing, but heard nothing. The eyes were fixed, motionless. They were surely inside the head of some creature, but it was too dark to see any part of the body. If the frozen eyes were any indication, however, the entire creature was locked in some unshakable pose. Stiffened with fright, maybe, or poised for an attack. A primitive thought crossed his mind, as if he were suddenly inside the small brain of his visitor. Is that thing over there edible? The piercing eyes glowed brighter, and finally, they blinked. A chill raced through Matthew. Fear gripped his heart. Do anacondas have eyelids? He suddenly heard breathing, his own. He didn't dare speak aloud, but silently he was talking himself out of his worst nightmare, assuring himself that it couldn't be an anaconda, that it was too cold up here in the mountains. Unless Joaquin brought it here. It would be the ultimate execution, a wrestling match with a hungry 18-foot snake. 10 horrific minutes of rolling in a hole as this monster coiled around his body and squeezed the life out of him, its massive jaws locked onto his head in a desperate effort to swallow him whole. Matthew was shaking, and the creature seemed to sense his fright, slowly, not more than a centimeter at a time. The eyes were creeping closer. It was decision time. If he burst out of the hole, he could well be shot by the guards. If he stayed put, God only knew what was in store for him. Carefully, he sat up, drew his knees in toward his body, and planted his feet on the ground. On the mental count of three, he summoned all his strength and shot straight up from the hole. His hands broke through the branches first, sending the makeshift roof splintering in all directions. A screeching noise followed him out of the hole, which only propelled him faster. He was clawing at stalks of bamboo, giant leaves, anything to get a grip and pull himself out. "Don't shoot!" he shouted, fearing it would look like an escape. He rolled to the ground outside his hole, tangled in the wet remnants of the thatched roof. He was swinging wildly in self-defense, not sure where those red eyes had gone. Something was at his ankle, then at his leg, and climbing up his belly. He rolled frantically and shouted, "Don't shoot!" A gun went off, and a hot, red explosion covered his torso.
"No se mueve!"
the guard shouted. Matthew froze, obeying the command to stop, though his chest heaved in panicky breaths. Slowly, his eyes adjusted to the daylight, and the glob of flesh beside him eventually came into focus. It was the biggest dead rat he'd ever seen. Joaquin and another gorilla stood over him, laughing. Behind them were 5 others nearly falling over in hysterics. Matthew was fuming. "Is this your idea of a joke? Turn a rat loose in my hole?" Joaquin's laughter faded. His eyes turned cold, colder than the rat's.
"Your hole?" he said, glaring.
The others fell silent. Matthew stared back, but he couldn't match the black intensity in Joaquin's eyes. He suspected drugs.
"It's not your hole," said Joaquin. "You have nothing here. Not even this hole. Do you understand?"
Matthew was silent.
"I asked you a question."
He still refused to answer. Joaquin raised his rifle and took aim at Matthew's chest.
"Answer me," he said harshly, "or you will own this hole forever."
Matthew stared down the long steel barrel. Finally, he said, "I understand." Joaquin jerked the rifle and fired off 2 quick rounds that splattered the rat beyond recognition, most of the mess landing on Matthew. Joaquin and his cronies laughed in chorus.
"You smell better now," he said.
Matthew didn't doubt it. After all that time in the hole, he felt like a human pest strip. Joaquin shouted to his men in Spanish. Matthew didn't catch it all, but it had something to do with the river, and he thought he heard the name Nisho, the young Japanese widow. With the gorilla's reaction, he knew that he'd heard correctly. 2 of them howled and started racing back to camp.
"Nisho!"
they shouted, sounding more stoned than ever.
"Nisho!"
They reached the river in 2 groups. 3 armed gorillas led Matthew to the bank. 10 meters behind were Joaquin, another gorilla, and Nisho. The makeup of the group gave Matthew concern. Joaquin, he decided, was just a sick sadist. 2 of the gorillas were bona fide sharpshooters, just itching for the chance to pop someone's skull. 2 others were confirmed hellraisers who passed the boredom at camp with drugs and silly target practice. They'd get crazy out of their minds and shoot mice with AK-47s, ant mounds with .45-caliber Lugers. Today they seemed more wired on Basuko than Matthew had ever seen them, All the way to the river, they'd been loud and pushing each other. It was a dangerous combination. Drugs, fully loaded automatic weapons, and a bunch of dead-end teenagers with zero respect for life. Stop, Joaquin said in Spanish. They'd reached a calm eddy in the river behind a huge fallen tree and a boulder as big as a house. The guerrillas positioned themselves along the bank, two on the log, two others atop the boulder. You can bathe here, said Joaquin. Matthew was more than ready. He started to remove his clothes, then went to the river's edge and tested the water. The cold was just about unbearable, so he retained a layer of clothing for warmth. He waded knee-deep into the eddy, hand-washing himself without full immersion, thankful to clean off the thick layer of filth that had crusted his clothes and body. You too, said Joaquin. He was speaking to Nisho, who had not yet moved. With some reluctance, she stepped toward the river and dipped her toe in. Clothes off, said Joaquin. The guerrillas were watching and grinning, almost giddy with anticipation. Matthew could see the fear in Nisho's eyes, and the direction this seemed to be taking had him worried.
It's too cold, she said.
Leave your clothes, he said sternly. Now! Slowly she removed her jacket and sweater, and then her boots. She was down to a blouse and pants. The rest, he said. She'll freeze, shouted Matthew. One of the sharpshooters fired a warning shot. It splashed in the water just inches from Matthew's knee. He backed off. Nisho looked nearly paralyzed with fright. Her eyes darted from one gawking gorilla to the next as her trembling hand unbuttoned her blouse. The catcalls started. The show was in full swing. Matthew turned his gaze toward the gorillas. They were a repugnant group, themselves in need of bathing. The fat guy was especially disgusting, a hideous tattoo covering the entire left side of his face. The word cerdo came to mind, pig. The pants, said Joaquin. Matthew heard the zipper, then the hoots. The gorillas atop the boulder were sharing a bottle of something. The fat one with the tattoo stood up and started dancing, which quickly degenerated into a vulgar pelvic thrust. The others applauded, egging him on. He jumped down from the boulder and went toward Nisho. She was wearing only underpants, her arms covering her breasts. Cerdo grabbed her clothes, then wadded them into a ball and pitched them to Joaquin. He held the bundle in open hands, as if offering Nisho her clothes. She came toward him, pleading as she reached for the bundle. He laughed in her face and quickly pitched it back to the fat guy. He made the same phony offer, and again Nisho fell for it. He tossed her clothes back to another gorilla. She was soon running back and forth, still trying to cover herself, tears streaming down her face. Stop it! Shouted Matthew. The sharpshooter responded with another warning, this one even closer. Matthew stopped in his tracks, still knee-deep in the eddy. Nisho! Nisho! Joaquin shouted. She was bouncing back and forth, one gorilla to the next, as they played keep away with her clothes. As she raced by Joaquin, he reached out and grabbed her by the panties, ripping them off. She screamed and fell. The gorillas shouted with excitement as Joaquin waved the panties over his head. The gorillas formed a circle around her, tossing her clothes from one to the next, over Nisho's head, behind her back, howling each time she reached up and exposed her nakedness. Joaquin put his gun aside and grabbed her from behind, taking a breast in each hand. She kicked and swung wildly as he lifted her from the ground, then bit his arm. He cried out and slapped her across the head. Matthew seized the moment and dived for Joaquin's gun. He got a hand on it, but only for a split second. Cerdo wrapped him across the head with the butt of his rifle. Matthew fell to the ground hard, bleeding from the head. Her screaming grew more shrill and desperate. The gorillas were shouting, no longer laughing. It was more like a barbaric chant. Matthew sensed that someone was standing over him, but his head was throbbing, his vision blurring. Gradually, the noises faded. He raised his head one last time, just high enough to see three men drag a screaming Nisho off behind the rocks. And then his world turned black.
Chapter 43.
Maria and I had travelled by boat up the coast from Puerto Cabezas, then hiked another half hour into the thick of the rainforest. The Mosquito Coast was living up to its name. I was covered with insect repellent, but nothing short of dousing myself in gasoline and setting myself on fire could have deterred these monsters. I was sure they'd drawn at least a pint of my blood by the time we reached the first clearing. We stopped for water from our canteens atop a barren, muddy hill. Hundreds of short sticks were protruding up from the ground. "What's with all the sticks?" I asked.
"Mudslide. The last hurricane. Used to be a village here. The sticks are where we found the bodies."
I took a wider look and saw even more sticks. Hundreds more in every direction, up one slope and down another. It was the jungle version of Arlington National Cemetery, except that everybody here, children included, had been washed away at the same horrific moment in the same giant river of mud. Maria fell silent, eyes closed, as if in prayer. I bowed my head and said a little one of my own. That was our last real break of the afternoon. We walked nonstop for 2 more hours, sharing water along the way, until we finally reached an old Mosquito Indian settlement at dusk. It was little more than a small clearing in the trees. There were no real roads, only footpaths that led from the hub to the forest in all directions, like the spokes of a wheel. In the center of the clearing was an old wooden building that appeared to be a combination church and schoolhouse. About a dozen tumble-down shacks surrounded it. A group of Indian children came out to greet us as we entered their village. I was suddenly surrounded by outstretched hands, some of them tugging at my backpack. They knew Maria by name, which lessened my anxiety.
"I used to teach here," she said over the incessant chatter of the children.
"Teach what?"
"Bible school."
I suddenly understood what had drawn her to Lindsay, a lost soul if ever there was one. Maria said something in the native Mosquito language, and the smiling children backed away, allowing us to pass. I followed her around to the back of the church, where she stopped at the door to a small cottage. She knocked twice, and the door opened. A woman with short blonde hair was standing in the doorway, the first Caucasian I'd seen since leaving Managua. The short hair threw me. In the waning daylight, I almost didn't recognize my own sister.
"Nick?" she said.
"I came to see if you want to change your long-distance carrier." She smiled, appreciating the humor, then came out and gave me a rather unexpected hug.
"I can't believe you're here."
"I can't believe you're here," I said. We didn't tell Maria that we wanted to talk alone, but on her own initiative, she headed off to chat with her former pupils. Lindsay led me inside, closed the door, and lit the oil lamp on the table. It was a one-room shack, and the lamp was the only source of light. The bed was a woven hammock. A pitcher and wash basin were resting on the nightstand beside it. The floor was a collection of straw mats on dirt. We sat at opposite sides of the table on the only 2 chairs in the room. She offered me a tin cup of water.
"You've had your shots, right?"
"I got them before I went to Colombia."
"You went to Colombia?"
The way she'd asked, it was clear that she didn't know about Dad. She seemed genuinely shocked as I told her all about the kidnapping. It took several minutes. I finished with the part that I assumed would be of greatest interest to her. "The insurance company thinks you're behind Dad's kidnapping."
"That's preposterous."
"That's what I thought. For starters, how would you even know he had kidnap and ransom insurance?" She paused, then said,
"Actually, I think I did know that."
"What do you mean?"
"Dad never came right out and told me he had it, but he wanted to buy a policy for me, and I guess I sort of assumed he had it for himself."
"Now I'm really confused. The last time you and I had a phone conversation, you said that you hadn't spoken to Mom or Dad since Christmas."
"The last time you and I talked was almost 3 months ago."
"Are you saying things have changed between you and Dad?"
"Honestly, we were becoming close." I put down my tin cup, leaned into the table, and looked her in the eye.
"Lindsay, knock off the games. Maria told me about you and Guillermo. I know all about the story you were writing on the plight of these divers."
"Did she also tell you that Dad was my source?"
"She said it was Guillermo. An unwitting Guillermo at that."
"Anybody who asked, I told them it was Guillermo. This is a dangerous story. Dad was really sticking his neck out by feeding me information."
"So you decided to put Guillermo's neck on the chopping block?"
He deserved it. The creep never told me he had a wife in Florida.
You didn't know he was married?
How would I? She's never here. I guess she prefers Palm Beach to Managua.
Go figure.
Anyway, after Dad dressed me down for dating his partner, we started meeting for coffee twice a week, that sort of thing. It didn't take long for him to realize that my journalism career was going nowhere. That's when he asked me to write this story.
You expect me to believe that he asked you to expose the abuses of his own company?
It's not about his company. Ray's Seafood trains its divers and uses the right equipment. Its divers get paid very well, too. That's why Dad's practically going out of business. He can't compete with some of these other companies that send untrained divers down all day long with no gauges.
So it's your job to write the story that will blow the competition out of the water, literally.
Exactly. And they're not too happy with me right now, which is why I'm hiding out in this shack.
Why didn't you just come home?
Because the story isn't finished yet, she said, without a moment's hesitation.
That was the most grown-up statement I'd ever heard my sister utter. I smiled with my eyes and said, I'm proud of you.
So was Dad.
I'll bet he was. But what about Guillermo?
Honestly, he thinks Ray's Seafood should shut up and do business the way some of his competitors do.
Did he tell you that?
Sure. Training and equipment cost money. I wasn't exaggerating when I said it was practically putting the company out of business. That's why Dad went to Colombia.
I don't understand.
Last time Dad and I talked, he said there were some good boats for cheap in Cartagena. Every extra boat they add to their fleet increases cash flow by about 50 grand a month. So Guillermo gave him two choices, cut the diving costs or go get the boats.
Guillermo sent Dad to Colombia?
He never told me that. Take it from me and his wife. He's not the most honest person I've ever met.
So I'm learning, I said, staring blankly at the flickering flame in the lamp.
What are you thinking?
After a moment or two, I looked back at my sister and said, I think it's time I had a serious talk with Guillermo. I woke to the sound of screaming monkeys. At least I thought it was monkeys. Lindsay and I had stayed awake late, just talking. I'm not sure what time we'd finally gone to bed, if you could call straw-covered earth a bed. I woke several times during the night with a horrendous backache. It made me think of my father sleeping on the cold ground in some mountain jungle night after night. A beam of sunlight was streaming in through a hole in the east wall. I rolled over to keep it from hitting me in the eyes, but sleep was out of the question anyway. I thought the screaming monkeys were at it again, and then I realized that all along it had been the unfamiliar ring of the satellite phone I'd rented for this trip. If I'd been insistent on going to Nicaragua, Alex had been equally insistent that I'd be reachable anywhere at any time, just in case of an emergency. I answered with trepidation, fearful of what an emergency might mean in my family these days.
Nick, I'm so glad I got you.
It was Jenna. She was one of three people who had the satellite number, along with Mom and Alex. Is everything okay?
Don't worry, it's only some legal maneuvering. I just got out of a hearing.
It seemed early for court, but then I realized that she was two time zones ahead of me. What happened?
I've been trying to keep the pressure on the insurance company while you're away. I got in front of the judge this morning and forced them to produce a company rep who will tell us exactly why your father's coverage was denied.
That's great.
The bad news is that Quality Insurance is a Bermuda-based company. Duncan Fitz convinced the judge that we have to go there if we want to take the deposition.
When is it?
That's why I'm calling. It's tomorrow.
Yikes!
It's the old adage, be careful what you wish for. I told the judge we wanted to move as quickly as possible for your father's sake.
You did exactly the right thing. Unfortunately, I'm literally in the middle of nowhere right now.
You want me to try to postpone it?
No, I'll do what I have to do to get home tonight.
Anything I can do here to help?
Buy me a pair of knee socks and Bermuda shorts?
With those knees, forget it.
I laughed, then said, you're coming to Bermuda with me, right?
Do you want me to?
Well, I'm up against my old firm. It's such short notice, we'll practically have to prepare on the plane as it is. I mean,
Nick, I just asked a question. Do you want me to go?
She wasn't being testy. She was just bringing me back to the only thing that mattered. Yes, I want you to go.
Then I'll go.
I smiled. I'll call you tonight, okay?
Sure. Have a safe flight.
As I switched off the phone, I felt upbeat that the deposition was set and that Jenna was coming with me. But the part we'd left unspoken was more than a little awkward, even ironic. Bermuda was the place we'd planned to go for our honeymoon.
This ends Disc 7. A King's Ransom, Disc 8.
Chapter 44. At 11 a.m., Jenna and I were seated side by side in the St. George's office of Cool Cash. Frankly, I'd been unaware that the firm even had a Bermuda office. Nice place to hold firm retreats for partners, I presumed. The office had just one resident barrister, who was currently seated at the end of the table reading the Wall Street Journal. The real warriors were seated across the table, Duncan from Miami and Maggie Johans from New York. As general counsel, Maggie was evidently staying right on top of every phase of the case. It had taken some doing for me to get out of Nicaragua in time for the deposition, and I never did get to talk with Guillermo. That would have to wait. "Swear the witness, please," I told the stenographer. Jason Lee was a vice president of Quality Insurance Company based in St. George's. He was a large man, husky but not fat, with salt and pepper hair that was thinning on top. His attire was the Bermuda businessman's uniform, khaki shorts and knee socks, Oxford cloth shirt and blue blazer. I covered the requisite preliminaries, and just as soon as I started asking questions of substance, Duncan jumped on me with objections. It was getting annoying, and I prepared for the worst as I moved to the heart of the matter. "Mr. Lee, why did Quality Insurance deny coverage?" He sipped his water.
"Legal reasons."
"Not to be flip, but the whole point here is to determine whether the reasons were legal, so let me try again. Why did Quality Insurance Company deny coverage?"
"We denied coverage on the advice of our legal counsel."
Duncan grumbled and said, "At this point I wish to caution the witness not to divulge any communications with the company's legal counsel. Those are protected by the attorney-client privilege." It was the kind of speaking objection that was designed to coach the witness, and I wasn't going to let Duncan get away with it. I'm not asking the witness to tell what his lawyer's advice was. I simply want to know the factual basis for the company's decision to deny coverage. Lee answered,
"I'm afraid I can't possibly tell you the factual basis without revealing the nature of the legal advice."
"Just tell me the facts that you presented to your lawyer."
"It's all intertwined. It's protected by the attorney-client privilege."
"This is the most ridiculous interpretation of the attorney-client privilege I've ever heard."
"Then take it up with the judge," said Duncan.
"The court has already ordered your client to tell us why it denied coverage. Either Mr. Lee is going to answer my questions, or I'll file a motion for sanctions." Duncan raised his hands, mocking me.
"Oh, gee, in that case, we give up. I'll have a cashier's check in the full amount of the $3 million policy in your hands before the close of business today."
Maggie chuckled and said, "Or perhaps your family and its so-called Nicaraguan fishing company would be more comfortable dealing with a suitcase full of cash." They shared a good laugh. And then Duncan glanced at the stenographer and said,
"Those last remarks are off the record."
"No way," I said. "I want it all on the transcript." The Bermuda barrister at the end of the table looked up from his Wall Street Journal, made eye contact with the stenographer, and simply cleared his throat. It was clear that the remarks would be off the record. Maggie smirked, pleased with the teamwork.
"Tell you what," I said. "Let's call Judge Corvan in Miami right now, see what she has to say about your objections."
The barrister jumped in again, sounding very British.
"Actually, the proper procedure in these particular circumstances is to petition a judge who has jurisdiction in Bermuda. I'll ring Uncle Henry straight away, get a direct answer for you chaps."
"Excellent idea," said Maggie.
"Thanks, but no thanks," I said flatly. "We'll call Judge Corvan, who's nobody's uncle."
"How long is this going to take?" asked Lee. "I have a 2 o'clock tea time at mid-ocean."
"You'll make your tea time," said Duncan.
"Don't be so sure," I said.
"Oh, I'm quite sure," said Duncan.
His tone was beyond confident, as if somehow he knew it was an absolute certainty. I could feel my anger rising, but Jenna reeled me in with a gentle tug on the elbow. Duncan said,
"Go ahead, hotshot, make your phone call."
We exchanged a cold glare. Then I picked up the phone and dialed Judge Corvan's chambers. All eyes were on the speakerphone in the center of the conference table. We were waiting to hear the voice of the Honorable Judge Peñas. My telephone call to Judge Corvan had been rerouted. For reasons unexplained, Judge Corvan had just today recused herself from the case. Her replacement was Humberto Peñas, a puppet who owed his seat on the Miami-Dade County bench to none other than Duncan Fitz. Finally, his secretary announced his arrival, and we heard the judge's voice over the box. "Good afternoon to all of you." Duncan seized the lead and introduced everyone. When the judge asked Duncan about his kids, identifying them by name, grade in school, and favorite sport, I knew I was in trouble. "So what seems to be the trouble in Bermuda?" the judge asked. I said, "Your Honor, there's a dispute over discovery." "Let me stop you right there, Mr. Ray. Why is there any discovery going on in this case?" "Because the insurance company has denied coverage, and we need to prove they were wrong." "I spoke to Judge Corvan about this case, and I have to tell you, I think she totally missed the boat. I don't see why Mr. Fitz's client should be subjected to intrusive discovery into its business decisions at this stage of the game." "It's hardly intrusive, Your Honor. My father's been kidnapped, and they won't provide coverage." "I understand that, but your insurance policy is a reimbursement policy. It reimburses you for any ransom payment that you make. You don't have a claim until you make a ransom payment and have an out-of-pocket loss." "That's technically correct, but if the insurance company hadn't denied coverage, I could have used the policy as security to borrow the ransom money. No bank is going to issue a line of credit against an insurance policy that is allegedly tainted with fraud." "That's very speculative, Mr. Ray. The insurance company is also supposed to pay for my negotiator. They aren't doing that." Duncan said, "That's a disingenuous argument he's making, Judge. We happen to know for a fact that the negotiator we originally assigned to this case is still working with Mr. Ray under some kind of agreement they've worked out." "Is that true, Mr. Ray?" "Her decision to stay on is certainly no doing of quality insurance companies." "I asked you a simple question. Is she still helping you?" "Yes, and I still have to pay her." "How much have you paid her so far?" "Nothing yet. Has she billed you?" "Technically, no. She said we'd work that out later. I fully intend to pay her something." Duncan was smiling. Maggie poked him in the ribs, urging him on.
"Judge, this wasn't the point of the telephone call, but I think we've gotten to the nub here. My client's only purpose in bringing this matter before Judge Corvan was to enforce the confidentiality provisions in the policy. With all due respect to Judge Corvan, you seem to have a better handle on things than she did. The resolution of Mr. Ray's claims is for another day."
"But I think I've got it," said the judge. "I'll fax you an order before 5 o'clock. Good day."
The judge disconnected. Maggie hung up from our end, then looked at me and said, "That went rather well, don't you think?"
"Go to hell, all of you." I glanced at the stenographer and said, "You can put that on the record." Chapter 45. It was a dark and stormy night. Two or three dark and stormies, actually. That was the signature cocktail of Bermuda. 2 parts ginger beer, 1 part dark rum. It fit the bill, as Jenna and I were in need of something pretty potent back at the bar in our hotel. The faxed order from Judge Peñas put a stay on all discovery, which meant that the entire case was at a halt. No depositions were to go forward, not of Jason Lee or anyone else. The evidentiary hearing was canceled with no date rescheduled. It was as if Duncan Fitz himself had written the order. Deep down, I suspected that he had.
"Any thoughts on what we do now?" asked Jenna.
"I guess we file an appeal to try to get the case back on track, but that could take months, which doesn't do my dad any good." Jenna stirred her drink, mixing the dark rum on top into the fizzing, stormy ginger beer.
"Last week I couldn't understand why Duncan wasn't scheduling any discovery or doing any of the things a lawyer would normally do with an evidentiary hearing less than 3 weeks away. I wonder if he knew back then that the hearing was going to be canceled."
"Of course he knew. Granted, cases get reassigned all the time, even without any string pulling, but it can't be an accident that this one landed in front of Peñas. Duncan couldn't have handpicked a more favorable judge.
Why is he being such a bastard?
Because he truly believes that my family defrauded him and his client. Duncan pushes hard in any case, but he'll push to the limit if he thinks he's been screwed.
Then why not just let his client say it under oath?
Maybe he has the same questions about Guillermo that I have. He doesn't want his client to go on record saying that Lindsay's the bad guy till they've sorted it all out.
I feel so awful for your father.
I signaled the bartender for two more dark and stormies. I hadn't eaten all day and already had a decent buzz. I knew better than to drink and drive, of course, but that didn't seem to keep me from blundering my way down certain metaphorical roads. Did you feel funny about coming to Bermuda with me? Jenna seemed to stiffen at the sudden turn in conversation.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean.
The fact that we were going to have our honeymoon here?
Well, yeah.
Not really.
I raised an eyebrow.
Well, maybe a little. She cracked a smile and said, okay, a lot.
Why did you come?
Gee, with questions like these, I may need Duncan Fitz to defend me.
She was trying to make light of it, but the way she was playing with her hair, I knew she was uncomfortable. The bartender set up our drinks. I finished the old one and started on the new. When you first agreed to help me with the case, you said you were doing it for my dad, not for me.
That was probably harsh. I'm sorry.
You don't have to apologize. I'm bringing it up only because it's an important piece in a big puzzle that's come together for me since the kidnapping. After all the disappointment that you and I went through, you still love my dad. My mom, after the drinking and everything else they went through, is still totally in love with him. Yesterday I saw Lindsay, and even she seems to have made a connection. It was last night while I was trying to fall asleep on the floor in Lindsay's hut when it hit me. Nobody seems to have any issues with my dad except me.
You've always said that, and to this day I don't understand what you mean. What issues?
I paused, thinking how best to put it. Did you ever know you loved someone, and know that they loved you too? And then this one thing happens. It might be a stupid thing, but for some reason you won't allow yourself to look past it. Forever and ever, it's stuck there, right between you.
I don't know. Maybe.
The crazy thing is, you know it doesn't belong there, keeping you apart. Yet, for some reason, neither one of you steps up and clears it away. It just festers. And before you know it, that stupid little thing actually defines your relationship. It might even destroy it. She blinked hard, as if my words were hitting too close to home. It was unintentional, but I knew where I'd led her to that day in the park, when I'd been such an idiot and told her no, 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 I wouldn't marry her, my well-intended but misguided way of keeping it a surprise that I'd already bought a ring to give her on her birthday.
I can see where something like that could happen, she said, staring into her drink.
Part of me wanted to seize the opportunity and make this conversation about us. But it promised to be an awfully long plane ride home if I took that leap and fell flat on my face now. I chickened out. Anyway, that's kind of what happened between me and my dad.
I'm sorry. What was the little thing?
What little thing?
The one that became such a big thing between you and your father.
Just something he did to me when I was 12.
You want to talk about it?
It's really not worth it. She seemed reluctant to pry.
You two do seem to have a strange relationship, she said vaguely.
You noticed, huh?
A week ago you said you didn't even know that your dad had a sister.
No one ever told me.
She sipped her drink and said, she died very young. Drowned, 7 years old.
My dad told you all that?
We had just that one short conversation at my father's funeral, the one I told you about. He only mentioned that he'd lost a sister. The rest I learned on my own.
When?
After I talked with you last week. My curiosity sort of ran away with me. I did a computer search on obituaries for anyone named Ray from the Florida Keys. Had to go back quite a ways, but I found it. Her name was Stacy. How did she drown? A boating accident was all it said. I made a copy if you want it.
Sure, thanks. I'd like to see it.
I selected a couple of cashews from the bowl of mixed nuts on the bar, then shook my head. This is exactly the sort of thing I don't understand about my father. Why wouldn't he tell me he had a sister who drowned?
Maybe it goes back to that thing you were talking about when you were 12.
What could that possibly have to do with his sister's drowning?
Hard for me to say, without your telling me what it was. And I'm not suggesting there's a direct link. More likely, it just turned out to be one of those pivotal moments in your relationship when your father decided that you didn't care. So he never got around to telling you about the sister he'd lost. He probably didn't tell you a lot of things. It wasn't worth it anymore.
I could have told her that she had it backward, that what had happened when I was 12 wasn't something I had done. It was something he had done to me. But I said nothing, knowing yet again that she wasn't really talking about me and my father. She was talking about us.
"Another round?" asked the bartender.
Jenna and I exchanged a quick glance. She looked sad, and I would have liked nothing more than to fix things. But she hadn't believed me then, and I didn't see why she'd believe me now. She probably never would believe that I truly had bought the ring before that blunder in the park, that I hadn't just panicked and asked her to marry me to keep her from running away. "No, thanks," I told the bartender. "I think we've had enough for one night."